the effects, everything. Good witnesses? The FBI director asked. As good as can be expected in this sort of case? It's time to move with it, Murray added. Shaw nodded in understanding. Word would soon begin to leak out. You simply couldn't run a covert investigation for very long, even under the best of circumstances. Some of the people you interviewed would be loyal to the target of the inquiry, and no matter how carefully you phrase the opening questions, they would make the not overly great leap of imagination required to discern the nature of the probe, often because they suspected it themselves. Then those non-witnesses would worry about getting back to the target to warn him, whether from conviction in his innocence or hope of deriving a personal profit. Criminal or not, the vice president was a man with considerable political power, still able to dole out large and powerful tokens to those who won his favor. In another age, the Bureau might not have gotten this far. The president himself, or even the attorney general, would have conveyed a quiet warning, and senior staff members would themselves have sought out the victims and offered to make amends of one sort or another, and in many cases it would have worked. The only reason they'd gotten this far after all was that the FBI had the permission of the president, the cooperation of the AG, and a different legal and moral climate in which to work. As soon as you go to talk to the chairman, Murray nodded. Yeah, might as well have a press conference and lay out our evidence in an organized way. But they couldn't do that, of course. Once the substance of their evidence was given over to political figures, in this case the chairman and ranking minority members of the House Committee on the Judiciary, it would leak immediately. The only real control Murray and his team would possess would be in selecting the time of day. Late enough, and the news would miss the morning papers, incurring the wrath of the editors of the Washington Post and the New York Times. The Bureau had to play strictly by the rules. It couldn't leak anything, because this was a criminal proceeding, and the rights of the target had to be guarded as closely as, actually, even closer than those of the victims, lest the eventual trial be tainted. "We'll do it here, Dan," Shaw said, reaching his decision. "I'll have the AG make the phone call and set the meet. Maybe that'll put the information on close hold for a little while. What exactly did the president say the other day?" "He's a stand-up guy," the deputy assistant director reported, using a form of praise popular in the FBI. "He said a crime's a crime." The president had also said to handle the affair in as black a way as possible, but that was to be expected. "Fair enough. I'll let him know what we're doing personally." Typically, Nomuri went right to work. It was his regular night at this bathhouse with this group of salarymen. He probably had the cleanest job in the agency. It was also one of the slickest ways of getting information he'd ever stumbled across, and he made it slicker still by standing for a large bottle of sake that now sat half-empty on the edge of the wooden tub. "I wish you hadn't told me about that round eye," Nomuri said with his own eyes closed, sitting in his usual corner and allowing his body to take in the enveloping heat of the water. At 108 degrees, it was hot enough to lower blood pressure and induce euphoria. Added to it was the effect of the alcohol. Many Japanese have a genetic abnormality called Oriental Flush in the West, or with greater ethnic sensitivity, pathological intoxication. It is actually an enzyme disorder, and means that for a relatively low quantity of alcoholic intake, there is a high degree of result. It was, fortunately, a trait which Nomuri's family did not share. "Why is that?" Kazuo Teoka asked from the opposite corner. "Because now I cannot get the Gaijin witch out of my mind," Nomuri replied good-naturedly. One of the other effects of the bathhouse was an intimate bonhomie. The man next to the CIA officer rubbed his head roughly and laughed, as did the rest of the group. "Ah, and you want to hear more, is it?" Nomuri didn't have to look. The man whose body rubbed on his leaned forward. Surely the rest would do it as well. "You were right, you know. Their feet are too big. And their bosoms also. But their manners, Well, they can learn, after a fashion. You'll make us wait? Another member of the group asked, feigning a blustery anger. Do you not appreciate drama? There was a merry chorus of laughs. Well, yes, it is true that our bosoms are too big for real beauty. But there are sacrifices we all must make in life, and truly, I have seen worse deformities. Such a good raconteur, Namori thought. He did have a gift for it. In a moment he heard the sound of a cork being pulled as another man refilled the little cups. Drink was actually prohibited in the bathhouse for health reasons, but rarely for this country it was a rule largely ignored. Namori reached for his cup, his eyes still closed, and made a great show of forming a mental picture masked by a blissful smile as additional details slid across the steaming surface of the water. The description became more specific, fitting ever closer to the photograph and to other details he'd been passed on his early morning train. It was hardly conclusive yet. Any of thousands of girls could fit the description, and Nomori wasn't particularly outraged by the event. She'd taken her chances one way or another, but she was an American citizen, and if it were possible to help her, then he would. It seemed a trivial sidebar to his overall assignment, but if nothing else, it had caused him to ask a question that would make him appear even more a member of this group of men. It made it more likely, therefore, to get important information out of them at a later date. "We have no choice," a man said in another similar bathhouse not so far away. "We need your help." It wasn't unexpected, the other five men thought. It was just a matter of who would hit the wall first. Fate had made it this man and his company. That did not lessen his personal disgrace at being forced to ask for help, and the other men felt his pain while outwardly displaying only dispassionate good manners. Indeed, those men who listened felt something else as well, fear. Now that it had happened once, it would be far easier for it to happen again. Who would be next? Generally, there could be no safer form of investment than real estate, real, fixed property with physical reality, something you could touch and feel, build and live on, that others could see and measure. Although there were continuing efforts in Japan to make new fill land, to build new airports, for example, the general rule was as true here as it was elsewhere. It made sense to buy land because the supply of real land was fixed, and because of that the price was not going to drop. But in Japan, that truth had been distorted by unique local conditions. Land use policy in the country was skewed by the inordinate power of the small holders of farmland, and it was not unusual to see a small patch of land in the midst of a suburban setting allocated to the growing of a quarter hectare of vegetables. Small already, the entire nation was about the size of California, and populated with roughly half the people of the United States, their country was further crowded by the fact that little of the land was arable. And since arable land also tended to be land on which people could more easily live, the major part of the population was further concentrated into a handful of large, dense cities, where real estate prices became more precious still. The remarkable result of these seemingly ordinary facts was that the commercial real estate in the city of Tokyo alone had a higher book value than that of all the land in America's 48 contiguous states. More remarkably still, this absurd fiction was accepted by everyone as though it made sense, when in fact it was every bit as madly artificial as the Dutch tulip mania of the 17th century. But as with America, what was a national economy after all but a collective belief? Or so everyone had thought for a generation. The frugal Japanese citizens saved a high proportion of their earnings. Those savings went into banks in such vast quantities that the supply of capital for lending was similarly huge, as a result of which the interest rates for those loans were correspondingly low, which allowed businesses to purchase land and build on it despite prices that anywhere else in the world would have been somewhere between ruinous and impossible. As with any artificial boom, the process had dangerous corollaries. the inflated book value of owned real estate was used as collateral for other loans and as security for stock portfolios bought on margin. And in the process, supposedly intelligent and far-seeing businessmen had in fact constructed an elaborate house of cards whose foundation was the belief that Metropolitan Tokyo had more intrinsic value than all of America between Bangor and San Diego. An additional consequence of this was a view of real estate value that more than any other factor had persuaded Japanese businessmen that American real estate, which after all looked pretty much the same as that in their own country, had to be worth more than what the foolish Americans charged for it. By the early 1990s had come disquieting thoughts. The precipitous decline of the Japanese stock market had threatened to put calls on the large margin accounts, and made some businessmen think about selling their land holdings to cover their exposures. With that had come the stunning but unsurprising realization that nobody wanted to pay book value for a parcel of land, that although everyone accepted book value in the abstract, actually paying the assumed price was, well, not terribly realistic. The result was that the single card supporting the rest of the house had been quietly removed from the bottom of the structure and awaited only a puff of breeze to cause the entire edifice to collapse, a possibility studiously ignored in the discourse between senior executives. Until now. The men sitting in the tub were friends and associates of many years' standing, and with Kozo Matsuda's quiet and dignified announcement of his company's current cash flow difficulties, all of them saw collective disaster on a horizon that was suddenly far closer than they had expected only 2 hours earlier. The bankers present could offer loans, but interest rates were higher now. The industrialists could offer favors, but those would affect the bottom-line profits of their operations, with adverse effects on already staggering stock prices. Yes, they could save their friend from ruin, along with which in their society came personal disgrace that would forever remove him from this intimate group. If they didn't, he would have to take his best chance to put some of his office buildings quietly on the market, hoping, quietly, that someone would purchase them at something akin to the assumed value. But that was most unlikely. This they knew. They themselves would not be willing to do it. And if it became known that book value was as fictional as the writings of Jules Verne, then they would suffer too. The bankers would have to admit that the security of their loans, and consequently the security of their depositors' money, was also a hollow fiction. A quantity of real money, so massive as to be comprehended only as a number, would be seen to have vanished as though by some sort of evil magic. For all these reasons, they would do what had to be done. They would help Matsuda and his company, receiving concessions in return, of course, but fronting the money he and his operations needed. The problem was that although they could do it once, probably twice, and maybe even a third time, events would soon cascade, finding their own precipitous momentum, and there would soon come a time when they could not do what was necessary to support the House of Cards. The consequences were not easily contemplated. All six of the men looked down at the water, unable to meet the eyes of the others, because their society did not easily allow men to communicate fear, and fear is what they all felt. They were responsible, after all. Their corporations were in their own hands, ruled as autocratically as the holdings of a J.P. Morgan. With their control came a lavish lifestyle, immense personal power, and, ultimately, total personal accountability. All the decisions had been theirs, after all, and if those decisions had been faulty, then the responsibility was theirs, in a society where public failure was as painful as death. "Yamada-san is right," one of the bankers said quietly without moving his body. "I was in error to dispute his view." Marveling at his courage, and as though in one voice, the others nodded and whispered, "Hai." Then another man spoke. "We need to seek his counsel on this matter." The factory worked two hectic shifts, so popular was what it turned out. Set in the hills of Kentucky, the single building occupied over 100 acres and was surrounded in turn by a parking lot for its workers and another for its products, with an area for loading trucks and another for loading trains run into the facility by CSX. The premier new car on American and Japanese markets, the Cresta, was named for the toboggan run at St. Moritz in Switzerland, where a senior Japanese auto executive, somewhat in his cups, had taken up a challenge to try his luck on one of the deceptively simple sleds. He'd rocketed down the track only to lose control at the treacherous shuttlecock curve, turned himself into a ballistic object, and dislocated his hip in the process. To honor the course that had given him a needed lesson in humility, he decided in the local casualty hospital to enshrine his experience in a new car, at that time merely a set of drawings and specifications. As with nearly everything generated by the Japanese auto industry, the Cresta was a masterpiece of engineering. Popularly priced, its front-wheel drive attached to a sporty and fuel-efficient 4-cylinder, 16-valve engine, it sat 2 adults in the front and 2 or 3 children quite comfortably in the back, and had become overnight both the Motor Trend Car of the Year and the savior of a Japanese manufacturer that had suffered 3 straight years of declining sales because of Detroit's rebounding efforts to take back the American market. The single most popular car for young adults with families, it came loaded with options and was manufactured on both sides of the Pacific to meet a global demand. This plant, set 30 miles outside Lexington, Kentucky, was state-of-the-art in all respects. The employees earned union wages without having had to join the UAW, and on both attempts to create a union shop supervised by the National Labor Relations Board, the powerful organization had failed to get even as much as 40% of the vote and gone away grumbling at the unaccustomed stupidity of the workers. As with any such operation, there was an element of unreality to it. Auto parts entered the building at one end and finished automobiles exited at the other. Some of the parts were even American-made, though not as many as the U.S. government would have wished. Indeed, the factory manager would have preferred more domestic content as well, especially in the winter, when adverse weather on the Pacific could interfere with the delivery of parts. Even a 1-day delay in arrival time of a single ship could bring some inventories dangerously low, since the plant ran on minimal overhead, and the demand for his Crestas was greater than his ability to manufacture them. The parts arrived mostly by train-loaded containers from ports on both American coasts, were separated by type and stored in stockrooms adjacent to the portion of the assembly line at which they would be joined with the automobiles. Much of the work was done by robots, but there was no substitute for the skilled hands of a worker with eyes and a brain, and in truth, the automated functions were mainly things that people didn't enjoy anyway. The very efficiency of the plant made for the affordable cost of the Cresta, and the busy schedule with plenty of overtime made for workers who, with this region's first taste of really well-paying manufacturing jobs, applied themselves as diligently as their Japanese counterparts, and their Japanese supervisors admitted quietly, both to themselves and in internal company memoranda, rather more creatively. Fully 12 major innovations suggested by workers on this line just in this year had been adopted at once in similar factories 6,000 miles away. The supervisory personnel themselves greatly enjoyed living in Middle America. The price of their homes and the expanse of land that came with them both came as startling revelations. And after the initial discomfort of being in an alien land, they all began the process of succumbing to local hospitality, joining the local lawyers on the golf links, stopping off at McDonald's for a burger, watching their children play t-ball with the local kids, often amazed at their welcome after what they'd expected. The local TV cable system had even added NHK to its service for the 200 families who wanted the flavor of something from home. In the process, they also generated a tidy profit for their parent corporation, which unfortunately was now trapped into barely breaking even on the Crestas produced in Japan due to the unexpectedly high productivity of the Kentucky plant and the continuing decline of the dollar against the yen. For that reason, additional land was being bought this very week to increase the capacity of the plant by 60%. a third shift, while a possibility would have reduced line maintenance, with a consequent adverse effect on quality control, which was a risk the company was unwilling to run, considering the renewed competition from Detroit. Early in the line, two workers attached the gasoline tanks to the frames. One, off the line, removed the tank from its shipping carton and set it on a moving track that carried it to the second worker, whose job was to manhandle the light but bulky artifact into place. Plastic hangers held the tank briefly until the worker made the attachment permanent, and the plastic hangers were then removed before the chassis moved on to the next station. The cardboard was soggy, the woman in the storage room noted. She held her hand to her nose and smelled sea salt. The container that had held this shipment of gas tanks had been improperly closed, and a stormy sea had invaded it. A good thing, she thought, that the tanks were all weather-sealed and galvanized. Perhaps 15 or 20 of the tanks had been exposed to seawater. She considered mentioning it to the supervisor, but on looking around she couldn't see him. She had the authority on her own to stop the line, traditionally a very rare power for an auto assembly worker, until the question of the gas tanks was cleared up. Every worker in the plant had that theoretical power, but she was new here and really needed her supervisor to make the call. Looking around more, she almost stopped the line by her inaction, which caused an abrupt whistle from the line worker. Well, it couldn't be that big a deal, could it? She slid the tank on the track, and opening the next box, forgot about it. She would never know that she was part of a chain of events that would soon kill one family and wound two others. 2 minutes later, the tank was attached to a Cresta chassis, and the not-yet-a-car moved on down the seemingly endless line toward an open door that could not even be seen from this station. In due course, the rest of the automobile would be assembled on the steel frame, finally rolling out of the plant as a candy-apple-red car already ordered by a family in Greenville, Tennessee. The color had been chosen in honor of the wife, Candace Denton, who had just given her husband Pierce his first son after 2 twin daughters 3 years earlier. It would be the first new car the young couple had ever owned, and was his way of showing her how pleased he was with her love. They really couldn't afford it, but it was about love, not money, and he knew that somehow he'd find a way to make it work. The following day, the car was driven onto a semi-trailer transporter for the short drive to the dealer in Knoxville. A telex from the assembly plant told the salesman that it was on the way, and he wasted no time calling Mr. Denton to let him know the good news. They'd need a day for dealer prep, but the car would be delivered a week late, due to the demand for the Cresta, fully inspected with temporary tags and insurance, and a full tank of gas, sealing a fate already decided by a multiplicity of factors. Chapter 7. Catalyst. It didn't help to do it at night. Even the glare of lights, dozens of them, didn't replicate what the sun gave for free. Artificial light made for odd shadows that always seemed to be in the wrong places, and if that weren't bad enough, the men moving around made shadows of their own, pulling the eyes away from their important work. Each of the SS-19/H-11 boosters was encapsulated. The construction plans for the capsule, called a cocoon here, had accompanied the plans for the missiles themselves, more or less as an afterthought. After all, the Japanese corporation had paid for all the plans, and they were in the same drawer, and so they went along. That was fortunate, the supervising engineer thought, because it had not seemed to have occurred to anyone to ask for them. The SS-19 had been designed as an intercontinental ballistic missile, a weapon of war, and since it had been designed by Russians, it had also been engineered for rough handling by poorly trained conscript soldiers. In this, the engineer admitted the Russians had showed true genius worthy of emulation. His own countrymen had a tendency to over-engineer everything, which often made for a delicacy that had no place in such brutish applications as this. Forced to construct a weapon that could survive adverse human and environmental factors, the Russians had built a transport loading container for their birds that protected them against everything. In this way, the assembly workers could fit all the plugs and fittings at the factory, insert the missile body into its capsule, and ship it off to the field where all the soldiers had to do was elevate it and then lower it into the silo. Once there, a better trained crew of 3 men would attach the external power and telemetry plugs. Though not as simple as loading a cartridge into a rifle, it was by far the most efficient way of installing an ICBM that anyone had ever developed. Efficient enough, indeed, that the Americans had copied it for their MX Peacekeeper missiles, all of which were now destroyed. The cocoon allowed the missile to be handled without fear because all the stress points had hard contact with the inside of the structure. It was rather like the exoskeleton of an insect, and was necessary because, as forbidding as the missile might appear, it was, in fact, as delicate as the flimsiest tissue. Fittings within the silo accepted the base of the capsule, which allowed it to be rotated to the vertical and then lowered fully into place. The entire operation, bad lighting and all, required 90 minutes, exactly what the Soviet manual had demanded of its people, remarkably enough. In this case, the silo crew consisted of 5 men. They attached 3 power cables along with 4 hoses that would maintain the gas pressure in the fuel and oxidizer tanks. The bird was not yet fueled, and the internal tanks needed pressure to maintain structural integrity. In the control bunker located 600 meters away within the valley's northeastern wall, the control crew of 3 men noted that the missile's internal systems spun up just as they were supposed to. It wasn't the least bit unexpected, but was gratifying even so. With that knowledge, they made a call to the phone located adjacent to the top of the silo, and the work crew waved the train off. The diesel switch engine would deposit the flat car back on a siding and retrieve the next missile. 2 would be in place that night, and on each of the 4 succeeding nights, filling all 10 of the silos. The senior personnel marveled at how smoothly it had all gone, though each wondered why it should be so surprising. It was perfectly straightforward work, after all, and, strictly speaking, it was. But each also knew that the world would soon be a very different place because of what they had done, and somehow they expected the sky to change color or the earth to move at every moment of the project. Neither had happened, and now the question was whether to be disappointed or elated by that turn of events.
"It is our opinion that you should take a harder line with them," Goto said in the sanctity of his host's office.
"But why?"
the Prime Minister asked, knowing the answer even so.
"They seek to crush us. They seek to punish us for being efficient, for doing better work, for achieving higher standards than what their own lazy workers are willing to attain." The leader of the opposition saved his assertive speaking voice for public utterances. In private, with the leader of his country's government, he was unfailingly polite in manner, even as he plotted to replace this weak, indecisive man.
"That is not necessarily the case, Goto-san. You know as well as I do that we have of late reasserted our position on rice and automobiles and computer chips. It is we who have won concessions from them and not the reverse."
The Prime Minister wondered what Goto was up to. Part of it he knew, naturally enough. Goto was maneuvering, with his usual crude skill, to realign the various factions in the Diet. The Prime Minister had a tenuous majority there, and the reason his government had taken a hard line on trade issues had been to assuage those on the margins of his voting bloc, ordinarily minor players and parties whose alliance of convenience with the government had magnified their power to the point where the tail really could wag the dog, because the tail knew that it held the balance of power. In this, the PM had played a dangerous game on the high wire, and without a net. On the one hand, he'd have to keep his own diverse political allies happy, and on the other, he couldn't offend his nation's most important trading partner. Worst of all, it was a tiring game, especially with people like Goto watching from below and howling at him, hoping that their noise would make him fall.
"As though you could do better," the Prime Minister thought, politely refilling Goto's cup with green tea, getting a gracious nod for the gesture.
The more basic problem he understood better than the leader of his parliamentary opposition. Japan was not a democracy in any real sense. Rather, like America in the late 19th century, the government was in fact, if not in law, a kind of official shield for the nation's business. The country was really run by a relative handful of businessmen. The number was under 30, or even under 20, depending on how you reckoned it. And despite the fact that those executives and their corporations appeared to be cutthroat competitors, in reality they were all associates, allied in every possible way. Co-directorships, banking partnerships, all manner of inter-corporate cooperation agreements. Rare was the parliamentarian who would not listen with the greatest care to a representative of one of the zaibatsu. Rarer still was the diet member who was graced with a personal audience with one of these men, and in every such case the elected government official came away exhilarated at his good fortune, for those men were quite effective at providing what every politician needed, funds. Consequently, their word was law. The result was a parliament as thoroughly corrupted as any on earth, or perhaps corrupt was the wrong term, the PM told himself. Subservient, perhaps. The ordinary citizens of the country were often enraged by what they saw, by what a few courageous journalists proclaimed, mostly in terms that, despite appearing to Westerners to be rather weak and fawning, in local context were as damning as anything Emile Zola had ever broadsheeted across Paris. But the ordinary citizens didn't have the effective power that the zaibatsu did, and every attempt to reform the political system had fallen short. As a result, the government of one of the world's most powerful economies had become little more than the official arm of businessmen, elected by no one, scarcely even beholden to their own stockholders. They had arranged his own accession to the prime ministership, he knew now. Perhaps a bone thrown to the common people, he wondered. Had he been supposed to fail? Was that the destiny that had been constructed for him? To fail so that a return to normal could then be accepted by the citizens who'd placed their hopes in his hands? That fear had pushed him into taking positions with America that he knew to be dangerous, and now even that was not enough, was it? Many would say that, Goto allowed with the most perfect manners. And I salute you for your courage. Alas, objective conditions have hurt our country. For example, the relative change of dollar and yen has had devastating effects on our investments abroad, and these could only have been the result of deliberate policy on the part of our esteemed trading partners. There was something about his delivery, the Prime Minister thought. His words sounded scripted. Scripted by whom? Well, that was obvious enough. The PM wondered if Goto knew that he was in even a poorer position than the man he sought to replace. Probably not, but that was scant consolation. If Goto achieved his post, he would be even more in the pawn of his masters, pushed into implementing policies that might or might not be well considered. And unlike himself, Goto might be fool enough to believe that he was actually pursuing policies that were both wise and his own. How long would that delusion last? It was dangerous to do this so often, Christopher Cook knew. Often? Well, every month or so. Was that often? Cook was a deputy assistant secretary of state, not an intelligence officer, and hadn't read that manual, assuming there was one. The hospitality was as impressive as ever, the good food and wine and the exquisite setting. The slow procession through topics of conversation, beginning with the polite and entirely pro forma inquiries as to the state of his family and his golf game, and his opinion on this or that current social topic. Yes, the weather was unusually pleasant for this time of year, a perennial remark on Seiji's part. Fairly enough, since fall and spring in Washington were tolerably pleasant, but the summers were hot and muggy and the winters wet and dank. It was tedious, even to the professional diplomat well-versed in meaningless chit-chat. Nagumo had been in Washington long enough to run out of original observations to make, and over the past few months had grown repetitive. Well, why should he be different from any other diplomat in the world, Cook asked himself, about to be surprised.
I understand that you have reached an important agreement with the Russians, Seiji Nagumo observed, as the dinner dishes were cleared away.
What do you mean? Cook asked, thinking it a continuation of the chit-chat.
We've heard that you are accelerating the elimination of ICBMs, the man went on, sipping his wine.
You're well informed, Cook observed, impressed, so much so that he missed a signal he'd never received before.
That's a rather sensitive subject. Undoubtedly so. But also a wonderful development, is it not?
He raised his glass in a friendly toast. Cook, pleased, did the same.
It most certainly is, the State Department official agreed. As you know, it's been a goal of American foreign policy since the late 1940s, back to Bernard Baruch, if memory serves, to eliminate weapons of mass destruction and their attendant danger to the human race, as you well know.
Nagumo surprisingly cut him off.
I know better than you might imagine, Christopher. My grandfather lived in Nagasaki. He was a machinist for the naval base that was once there. He survived the bomb. His wife did not, I regret to tell you. But he was badly burned in the ensuing fire, and I can well remember his scars. The experience hastened his death, I am sorry to say.
It was a card skillfully played, all the more so that it was a lie.
I didn't know, Seiji. I'm sorry, Cook added, meaning it. The purpose of diplomacy, after all, was to prevent war whenever possible, or, failing that, to conclude them as bloodlessly as possible.
So, as you might imagine, I am quite interested in the final elimination of those horrible things.
Nagumo topped off Cook's glass. It was an excellent Chardonnay that had gone well with the main course.
Well, your information is pretty accurate. I'm not briefed in on that stuff, you understand, but I've caught a few things at the lunchroom, Cook added, to let his friend know that he dined on the 7th floor of the State Department building, not in the more plebeian cafeteria.
My interest, I admit, is personal. On the day the last one is destroyed, I plan to have a personal celebration and to offer prayers to Grandfather's spirit, to assure him that he didn't die in vain.
Do you have any idea when that day will be, Christopher?
Not exactly. No, it's being kept quiet.
Why is that? Nagumo asked.
I don't understand.
Well, I suppose the president wants to make a big deal about it. Every so often, Roger likes to spring one on the media, especially with the election year on the horizon.
Seiji nodded.
Ah, yes. I can see that. So, it is not really a matter of national security, is it? He inquired offhandedly.
Cook thought about it for a second before replying.
Well, no, I don't suppose it is, really. True, it makes us more secure, but the manner in which that takes place is, well, pretty benign, I guess.
In that case, could I ask a favor?
What's that? Cook asked, lubricated by the wine and the company, and the fact that he'd been feeding trade information to Nagumo for months.
Just as a personal favor, could you find out for me the exact date on which the last missile will be destroyed?
You see, he explained, the ceremony I will undertake will be quite special, and it requires preparation.
Cook almost said, sorry, Seiji, but that is, technically speaking, a national security matter, and I never agreed to give anyone that sort of information.
The hesitation on his face and the surprise that caused it overpowered his normal diplomat's poker face. His mind raced, or tried to, in the presence of his friend.
Okay, sure. For 3.5 years he talked over trade issues with Nagumo, occasionally getting information that was useful, stuff he'd used, earning him a promotion to DASS rank, and occasionally he'd given over information because...
Because why?
Because part of him was bored with the State Department grind and federal salary caps, and once upon a time a former colleague had remarked to him that with all the skills he'd acquired in 15 years of government service, he really could escape into private industry, become a consultant or lobbyist, and hell, it wasn't as though he was spying on his country or anything, was it?
Hell no, it was just business, man. Was this spying? Cook asked himself. Was it really? The missiles weren't aimed at Japan and never had been. In fact, if the papers were right, they weren't aimed at anything except the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and the net effect of their destruction was exactly zero on everyone. Nobody hurt, nobody really helped, except in budgetary terms, and that was pretty marginal for all concerned. So, no, there wasn't a national security element to this, was there? No. So he could pass that information along, couldn't he? Okay, Seiji, I guess this once, yeah, I can see what I can find out.
Thank you, Christopher, Nagumo smiled. My ancestors will thank you. It will be a great day for the entire world, my friend, and it deserves proper celebration.
In many sports, it was called follow-through. There was no term for it in espionage. You know, I think it does, too, Cook said after a further moment's contemplation. It never occurred to him to be amazed that the first step over the invisible line that he had himself constructed was as easy as this.
I am honored, Yamata said with a great show of humility. It is a fortunate man who has such wise and thoughtful friends. It is you who honor us, one of the bankers insisted politely. Are we not colleagues? Do we not all serve our country, our people, our culture with equal devotion? You, Ichiki-san, the temples you've restored, ah! He waved his hand around the low-polished table. We've all done it, asking nothing in return but the chance to help our country, making it great again and then actually doing it, Yamata said. So, how may I be of service to my friends this evening?
His face took on a quiet, passive mien, waiting to be told that which he already knew. His closest allies around the table, whose identity was not really known to the other 19, were studies of curious anticipation, skilled as he was in concealment. But for all that, there was tension in the room, an atmosphere so real that you could smell it like the odor of a foreigner. Eyes turned almost imperceptibly to Matsuda-san, and many actually thought that his difficulties would come as a surprise to Yamata, even though the request for the meeting must have ignited his curiosity enough to turn loose his formidable investigative assets. The head of one of the world's largest conglomerates spoke with quiet, if sad, dignity, taking his time, as he had to, explaining that the conditions that had brought about his cash flow problem had not, of course, been the fault of his management. It was a business that had begun with shipbuilding, branched out into construction, then delved into consumer electronics. Matsuda had ridden to its chairmanship in the mid-1980s and delivered for his stockholders such return as many only dreamed of. Matsuda-san gave the history himself, and Yamata did not show the least impatience. After all, it worked in his favor that all should hear in his words their own corporate success stories, because in seeing the similarity of success, they would also fear a similarity of personal catastrophe. That the Cretan had decided to become a major player in Hollywood, pissing away an immense quantity of cash for 80 acres on Melrose Boulevard and a piece of paper that said he could make movies. Well, that was his misfortune, was it not?
The corruption and dishonor of those people is truly astounding, Matsuda went on, in a voice that a Catholic priest might hear in a confessional, causing him to wonder if the sinner was recanting his sins or merely bemoaning his bad luck. In the case at hand, $2 billion were as thoroughly gone as if burned to cook sausages. Yamata could have said, I warned you, except that he hadn't, even after his own investment counselors, Americans in this particular instance, had examined the very same deal and warned him off in the strongest terms. Instead, he nodded thoughtfully.
Clearly you could not have anticipated that, especially after all the assurances you were given, and the wonderfully fair terms you gave in return. It would appear, my friends, that proper business ethics are lost on them.
He looked around the table to collect the nods his observations had earned.
Matsuda-san, what reasonable man could say that you were in any way at fault?
Many would, he answered, rather courageously, all thought.
Not I, my friend. Who among us is more honorable, more sagacious? Who among us has served his corporation more diligently?
Raizo Yamada shook his head sorrowfully.
Of greater concern, my friends, is that a similar fate could await us all, a banker announced quietly, meaning that his bank held the paper on Matsuda's real estate holdings, both in Japan and America, and that the failure of that conglomerate would reduce his reserves to dangerous levels. The problem was that even though he could survive the corporate failure in both real and theoretical terms, it required only the perception that his reserves were weaker than they actually were to bring his institution down, and that idea could appear in a newspaper merely through the misunderstanding of a single reporter. The consequences of such a misguided report or rumor could begin a run on the bank and make real what was not. Certainly, the money withdrawn would then be deposited elsewhere. There was too much to go under mattresses, after all, in which case it would be lent back by a fellow corporate banker to safeguard his colleague's position. But a second-order crisis, which was quite possible, could bring everything crashing down. What went unsaid, and for that matter largely unthought, was that the men in this room had brought the crisis upon themselves through ill-considered dealings. It was a crucial blind spot that all shared, or nearly all, Yamada told himself. The basic problem is that our country's economic foundation rests not on rock, but on sand, Yamada began, speaking rather like a philosopher. As weak and foolish as the Americans are, fortune has given them things which we lack. As a result, however clever our people are, we are always at a disadvantage. He had said all of this before, but now, for the first time, they were listening, and it required all of his self-control not to gloat. Rather, he dialed back his level of rhetoric even more than he had in previous discourses. He looked over to one of them who'd always disagreed with him before.
Remember what you said. That our real strengths are the diligence of our workers and the skill of our designers.
That was true, my friend. These are strengths, and more than that, they are strengths that the Americans do not have in the abundance which we enjoy. But because fortune has, for reasons of her own, smiled on the Kaijin, they can checkmate our advantages because they have converted their good fortune into real power, and power is something we lack.
Yamada paused, reading his audience once more, watching their eyes and gauging the impassivity there. Even for one born of this culture and reared in its rules, he had to take his gamble now. This was the moment he was sure of it.
But really, that is not entirely the case either. They chose to take that path, while we have chosen not to. And so, now we must pay the price for that misjudgment. Except for one thing.
And what is that?
Asked one for all the others.
Now, my friends, fortune smiles on us and the path to real national greatness is open to us. In our adversity, we may, if we choose, find opportunities. Yamada told himself that he had waited 15 years for this moment. Then he considered the thought, watching and waiting for a response, and realized that he'd really waited a lifetime for it, since the age of 10, when, in February 1944, he alone of his family had boarded the ship that would take him from Saipan to the home islands. He could still remember standing at the rail, seeing his mother and father and younger siblings standing there on the dock, Raizo being very brave and managing to hold back his tears, knowing, as a child knows, that he would see them again, but also knowing that he would not. They'd killed them all, the Americans, erased his family from the face of the earth, encouraged them to cast their lives away off the cliffs and into the greedy sea, because Japanese citizens, in uniform or out, were just animals to the Americans.
Yamada could remember listening to the radio accounts of the battle, how the wild eagles of the Kidobutai had smashed the American fleet, how the Emperor's invincible soldiers had cast the hated American Marines back into the sea, how they had later slaughtered them in vast numbers in the mountains of the islands claimed from the Germans after the First World War, and even then he'd known the futility of having to pretend to believe lies. For lies they had to be, despite the comforting words of his uncle. And soon the radio reports had gone on to other things, the victorious battles over the Americans that crept ever closer to home, the uncomprehending rage he'd known when his vast and powerful country had found herself unable to stop the barbarians, the terror of the bombing, first by day and then by night, burning his country to the ground one city at a time, the orange glow in the night sky, sometimes near, sometimes far, and the lies of his uncle trying to explain it, and last of all, the relief he'd seen on the man's face when all was over. Except that it had never been relief for Ryuzo Yamada, not with his family gone, vanished from the face of the earth, and even when he'd seen his first American, a hugely tall figure with red hair and freckles on his milky skin, who'd clipped him on the head in the friendly way one might do for a dog. Even then he'd known what the enemy looked like. It wasn't Matsuda who spoke in reply. It couldn't be. It had to be another, one whose corporation was still immensely strong, or apparently so. It also had to be one who had never agreed with him. The rule was as important as it was unspoken, and though eyes didn't turn, thoughts did. The man looked down at his half-empty cup of tea. This was not a night for alcohol, and pondered his own fate. He spoke without looking up, because he was afraid to see the identical look in the eyes arrayed around the black lacquer table. "How, Yamada-san, would we achieve that which you propose?" "No shit," Chavez asked. He spoke in Russian, for you were not supposed to speak English here at Monterey, and he hadn't learned that colloquialism in Japanese yet. 14 agents, Major Oleg Yuryevich Lyalin, KGB, retired, replied, as matter-of-factly as his ego allowed. "And they never reactivated your net?" Clark asked, wanting to roll his eyes. "They couldn't," Lyalin smiled and tapped the side of his head. "Thistle was my creation. It turned out to be my life insurance." "No shit," Clark almost said. That Ryan had gotten him out alive was somewhere to the right of a miracle. Yalin had been tried for treason with the normal KGB attention to a speedy trial, had been in a death cell and known the routine as exactly as any man could. Told that his execution date was a week hence, he'd been marched to the prison commandant's office, informed of his right as a Soviet citizen to appeal directly to the president for executive clemency, and invited to draft a handwritten letter to that end. The less sophisticated might have thought the gesture to be genuine. Lyalin had known otherwise. Designed to make the execution easier, after the letter was sealed he would be led back to his cell, and the executioner would leap from an open door to his right, place a pistol right next to his head, and fire. As a result, it was not overly surprising that his hand had shaken while holding the ballpoint pen, and that his legs were rubbery as he was led out. The entire ritual had been carried out, and Oleg Yuryevich remembered his amazement on actually reaching his basement cell again, there to be told to gather up what belongings he had and to follow a guard, even more amazingly, back to the commandant's office, there to meet someone who could only have been an American citizen, with his smile and his tailored clothes, unaware of KGB's wry valedictory to its traitorous officer. "I would have pissed my pants," Ding observed, shuddering at the end of the story. "I was lucky there," Yalin admitted with a smile. "I urinated right before they took me up. My family was waiting for me at Sheremetyevo. It was one of the last Pan Am flights." "Hit the booze pretty hard on the way over?" Clark asked with a smile. Oh, yes, Oleg assured him, not adding how he'd shaken and then vomited on the lengthy flight to New York's JFK International Airport and had insisted on a taxi ride through New York to be sure that the impossible vision of freedom was real. Chavez refilled his mentor's glass. Yalin was trying to work his way off hard liquor and contented himself with Coors Light. I've been in a few tight places, Tavarich, but that one must have been really uncomfortable. I have retired, as you see, Domingo Estebanovich. Where did you learn Russian so well? The kid's got a gift for it, doesn't he? Clark noted, especially the slang. Hey, I like to read, okay? And whenever I can, I watch Russian TV at the home office and stuff. What's the big deal? The last sentence slipped out in English. Russian didn't quite have that euphemism. The big ideal is that you're truly gifted, my young friend, Major Yalin said, saluting with his glass. Chavez acknowledged the compliment. He hadn't even had a high school diploma when he'd sneaked into the U.S. Army, mainly by promising to be a grunt, not a missile technician. But it pleased him that he had indeed raced through George Mason University for his subsequent undergraduate degree, and was now within a dissertation of his master's. He marveled at his luck and wondered how many others from his barrio could have done as well, given an equal smile from chance.
So does Mrs. Foley know that you left a network behind?
Yes, but all her Japanese speakers must be elsewhere. I don't think they would have tried to reactivate without letting me know. Besides, they will only activate if they are told the right thing.
Jesus, Clark whispered, also in English, since one only swears in his native tongue. That was a natural consequence of the agency's de-emphasis of human intelligence in favor of electronic bullshit, which was useful but not the be-all and end-all that the paper pushers thought it to be. Of CIA's total of over 15,000 employees, somewhere around 4,050 of them were field officers, actually out on the street or in the weeds, talking to real people, and trying to learn what their thoughts were instead of counting beans from overheads and reading newspaper articles for the rest. You know, sometimes I wonder how we ever won the fucking war.
America tried very hard not to, but the Soviet Union tried harder, Yalin paused. Thistle was mainly concerned with gathering commercial information. We stole many industrial designs and processes from Japan, and your country's policy is not to use intelligence services for that purpose.
Another pause.
Except for one thing.
What's that, Oleg? Chavez asked, popping another Coors open.
There is no real difference, Domingo. Your people, I tried for several months to explain that to them. Business is the government over there. Their parliament and ministries, they are the legend. The Moskerovske for the business empires.
In that case, there's one government in the world that knows how to make a decent car, Chavez chuckled. He'd given up on buying the Corvette of his dreams, the damn things just cost too much, and settled on a Z that was almost as sporty for half the price. And now he'd have to get rid of it, Ding told himself. He had to be more respectable and settled if he were going to marry, didn't he?
Yet, you should understand this. The opposition is not what your country thinks it is. Why do you suppose you have such problems negotiating with them? I discovered this fact early on, and KGB understood it readily.
As they had to, Clark told himself, nodding. Communist theory predicted that very fact, didn't it?
Damn, wasn't that a hoot.
How are the pickings, he asked.
Excellent, Yalin assured him. Their culture, it's so easy for them to take insults, but so hard for them to respond. They conceal much anger. Then all you need do is show sympathy.
Clark nodded again, this time thinking, this guy is a real pro. 14 well-placed agents. He still had the names and addresses and phone numbers in his head, and unsurprisingly, nobody at Langley had followed up on it because of those damn fool ethics laws foisted on the agency by lawyers, a breed of government servant that sprouted up like crabgrass everywhere you looked, as though anything the agency did was, strictly speaking, ethical at all. Hell, he and Ding had kidnapped Corp, hadn't they? In the interests of justice, to be sure, but if they'd brought him to America for trial instead of leaving them with his own countrymen, some high-priced and highly ethical defense attorney, perhaps even acting pro bono, obstructing justice for free, Clark told himself, would have ranted and raved first before cameras and later before 12 good men and women about how this patriot had resisted an invasion